His suit and overcoat were hardly Savile Row, but owing to his slender frame they fit him well. His school tie was carefully knotted, his Oxfords shone with fresh polish. The trained eye might have noticed a telltale watchfulness in his gaze, but otherwise there was nothing about his dress or aspect to suggest he was bound for the hideous secret citadel that loomed over the foot of Vauxhall Bridge. Bennett had never cared for it. He much preferred dreary old Century House, the anonymous 20-story concrete office block where he had arrived as a new recruit in the dying days of the Cold War. Like all the other probationers in his intake, he had not applied to work for the Secret Intelligence Service. One did not ask to join Britain's most exclusive club. One was invited. And only if one came from the right sort of family, had the right sort of connections, and had earned a decent degree from either Oxford or Cambridge. In Bennett's case, it was Cambridge, where he had studied the history and languages of the Middle East. By the time he arrived at MI6, he spoke Arabic and Persian fluently. Stick in hand, rucksack on his back, he struck out along Coppice Row. He passed a couple of shops and restaurants, the village hall and the parish church. A thin fog hung over Thaden Plain like the smoke of a distant battle. Then the forests followed him. The trail was wide and smooth and covered with fallen leaves. Ahead, a woman of about 40 emerged from the gloom and, smiling, bade him a pleasant morning. She reminded him of Magda. Magda. He had met her at the Rose and Crown one night, when he stopped for a beer rather than rush home to Hester's cold embrace. She was a recent immigrant from Poland, or so she said. She was a beautiful woman, newly divorced, with luminous white skin and a wide mouth that smiled easily. She claimed she was meeting a friend, a girlfriend, not a man, and that the friend was running late. Bennett was suspicious. Nevertheless, he had a second drink with her. And when the friend sent a text saying she had to cancel, he agreed to walk Magda home. "House of Saud," answered Bennett. "The source has been working on our behalf for several years. He briefs us regularly on internal family matters and political developments inside the kingdom." "You are the Middle East controller, Charles. Why am I hearing about this only now?" "The source was recruited and run by London Station. I was told about him only this week."
"By whom?"
"See himself."
"Why did Graham decide to bring you into the picture?"
"Because the highly placed asset is coming to London in a few weeks for an official visit."
"What are you talking about?"
"Crown Prince Abdullah, the next king of Saudi Arabia, is an asset of MI6.
We own him, Yevgeny. He's ours."
52. Moscow. The dream came to Rebecca, as it always did, in the last hours before dawn. She was submerged in shallow water near the bank of a tree-lined American. Listened to the news from home on the BBC World Service, followed the cricket scores religiously in the Times, spread English marmalade on his toast and English mustard on his sausages, and drank Johnny Walker Red Label, nearly always to the point of unconsciousness. As a child, Rebecca had witnessed his titanic drinking during her clandestine visits to Russia. She had loved him nonetheless, and loved him still. It was his face she saw when she examined her appearance in the bathroom mirror. The face of a traitor. The face of a spy. Dressed, Rebecca bundled herself in a woolen overcoat and scarf and rode the elevator to the lobby. Her chauffeured Mercedes sedan waited in Sadovnicheskaya Street. She was surprised to find Leonid Ryzhkov, her immediate superior at Moscow Center, in the back seat. She ducked inside and closed the door. "Is there a problem?"
"That depends."
The driver made a hard U-turn and accelerated rapidly. Moscow Center was in the opposite direction. "Where are we going?" Eyes had a slight upward cast. Somehow he managed to convey both boredom and menace simultaneously. Rebecca supposed he practiced the expression in the mirror. "I assume," she said after a moment, "that Khalid's abdication wasn't voluntary."
"No."
The president gave a half-smile. Then the life drained once more from his features.
"We encouraged him to relinquish his claim to the throne."
"How?" The president shot a glance at Ryzhkov, who briefed Rebecca on the operation that had led to Khalid's removal from the line of succession.
It was monstrous. There was no other word for it. But then Rebecca always knew the Russians didn't play by the same rules as MI6.
"We went to a great deal of trouble to make Abdullah the next king of Saudi Arabia," Ryzhkov was saying. "But now it seems we've been deceived."
He waved the cable from London, dramatically, like a barrister in a courtroom.
"Or maybe this is the deception. Perhaps MI6 is up to its old tricks. Perhaps they merely want us to..."
"Me? Who better to run a major operation in London? It's not the sort of thing I do. Are you not the director of the United Kingdom Department of the SVR?
Deputy director?"
"Yes, of course." The president glanced at Leonid Ryzhkov. "My mistake." 54. Moscow, Washington, London. It was the assumption of the SVR's counterintelligence directorate that MI6 did not know Colonel Rebecca Philby's Moscow address. In point of fact, that was not the case. MI6 learned the location of her apartment quite by chance when one of its Moscow-based officers spotted her walking along the Arbat with a pair of bodyguards and a formidable-looking woman of advanced years. The officer followed them to Kuntsevo Cemetery, where they placed flowers on the grave of history's greatest traitor, then to the entrance of a smart new apartment building on Sadovnik in the Saudi line of succession. What kind of change? The kind that eventually places KBM's ass on the throne? Khalid is damaged goods. Khalid is the best we can hope for, and you know it. He loves us, and for some reason, he's reasonably fond of you. What do we do about Abdullah? He would have to be moved aside.
Moved aside?
Payne stared at Gabriel blankly.
Mars, really?
After dinner, Gabriel was driven in a CIA motorcade to the Madison Hotel in downtown Washington. Exhausted, he fell into a dreamless sleep, but was awakened at 3:19 a.m. by an urgent message on his BlackBerry. At dawn, he went to the Israeli embassy and remained there until early afternoon when he left for Dulles Airport. He had told his American hosts he was planning to return to Tel Aviv. Instead, at 5:30, he boarded a British Airways flight to London. Brexit had produced at least most of his face.
"Recognize him?" she asked.
"No." Mikhail Abramov aimed a remote at the screen and pressed play.
"How about now?"
The man approached a Toyota hatchback, tossed the bag into the back seat, and dropped behind the wheel. The lights burst on automatically when the engine started, a small mistake in tradecraft. The man quickly switched them off and reversed out of the space. A few seconds later, the car disappeared from the camera's view. Mikhail hit pause.
"Nothing?"
Gabriel shook his head.
"Watch it again, but this time, pay careful attention to the way he walks. You've seen it before."
Mikhail played the video a second time. Gabriel focused only on the man's athletic gait. Mikhail was right. He had seen it before. The man had walked past the front of Gabriel's car in Geneva, a few minutes after leaving his briefcase behind at Café Raymore. Mikhail had been walking a few paces behind him.
"I wish I could take credit for the tree. There was nothing but a church, a few farms, and a cluster of cottages.
Then a man called Richard Powell Cooper laid out a golf course along the sea, and there arose a resort town with stately homes lining broad avenues and several luxury hotels along the Esplanade. Connaught Avenue, the town's main thoroughfare, became known as the Bond Street of East Anglia. The Prince of Wales was a frequent visitor, and Winston Churchill once rented a house for the summer. When the Germans dropped their last bomb on Britain in 1944, it landed on Frinton-on-Sea. Though the town was no longer a fashionable resort, Frintonians had clung with varying degrees of success to the genteel ways of the past. Older, wealthier, and deeply conservative, they did not hold with immigrants, the European Union, or the policies of the Labour Party. Much to their dismay, Frinton's first pub, the Lock and Barrel, had recently opened its doors on Connaught Avenue. It was still a violation of the town's bylaws, however, to sell ice cream on the beach. His career was effectively over. Were it not for Gabriel and Graham Seymour, whom he greeted warmly, it might have ended much sooner. The Prime Minister glanced at his wristwatch. "I have dinner guests.
I'm sorry, said Seymour. Well, I'm afraid we have a rather serious situation regarding the Russians.
Not again.
Seymour nodded gravely.
And the nature of this situation?
A known SAR assassin has entered the country.
Where is he now?
A small hotel in Essex, the Bedford House.
I remember it fondly from my youth, said Lancaster.
I take it the Russian is under surveillance?
Total, answered Seymour.
Four MI6 watchers have checked into the hotel next door, the East Anglia Inn, along with two highly experienced Israeli field officers. Tech ops have planted transmitters in the Russian's room, audio and video. They've also hacked into the Bedford's internal network of security cameras. We're watching his every move.
Do we have anyone inside the Bedford?
Christopher Keller, he's the one who...
I know who he is, interjected Lancaster,
who explained that Bennett had twice been observed meeting with his SVR handler, Yevgeny Teplov, in Epping Forest.
Another spy scandal, said Lancaster. Just what the country needs.
We always knew there would be others, Prime Minister. Rebecca was in the perfect position to spot officers who might be vulnerable to a Russian approach.
How did Bennett escape detection until now?
He went dormant after Rebecca's capture. We took a hard look at him, but
you failed to notice another Russian spy staring you in the face.
No, Prime Minister. I left a suspected Russian spy in place so I might use him later to destroy the woman who destroyed my service.
Rebecca Manning. Seymour nodded.
Explain. If we arrest the members of an SAR hit team on the eve of your meeting with Abdullah, the Russians will suffer enormous international damage and Rebecca will come under suspicion as the source of the leak.
The Russians will think she's a triple agent? Is that what you're suggesting?
Indeed. The Prime Minister made a show of thought.
Isn't.
Gabriel allowed a moment to pass. Today is Tuesday.
I don't need a spy to tell me what day it is. That's what I have Jeffrey for.
Your meeting with Abdullah isn't until Thursday. Let us watch and listen for 36 hours.
36 hours is out of the question.
Lancaster pondered his wristwatch.
But I can give you 24. We'll reconvene tomorrow evening.
He rose abruptly.
Now, if you don't mind, gentlemen, I'd like to finish my dinner.
57. Oudorp, the Netherlands. The holiday bungalow stood in a cleft in the dunes outside the village of Oudorp. It was white as a wedding cake, with a red tile roof. Plexiglass barriers shielded the small terrace from the wind, which blew without relent from the North Sea. Unheated, lightly insulated, it was scarcely habitable in winter. Occasionally, a brave soul in search of solitude might rent it in May, but typically it sat unoccupied until it to the A-12. Diligently, she scanned the road behind her for signs of surveillance, but when darkness fell, her mind began to drift. She thought about the night she and her parents had fled East Berlin. They had made the journey aboard a stinking Soviet transport plane. One of the other passengers was a little man with sunken cheeks and dark circles under his eyes. He worked with Anna's father at the KGB's Dresden Bureau. He was a nobody who spent his days posing as a translator and clipping articles from German newspapers. Somehow, the little nobody was now the most powerful man in the world. In the span of a few years, he had wreaked havoc on the post-war global economic and political order. The European Union was in shambles. NATO was hanging by a thread. After meddling in the politics of Britain and America, he had meddled in Saudi Arabia's. Anna and Nikolai had helped him alter the line of succession in the House of Saud. Now, for reasons that had not been made fully clear to them, they were about to alter it again. Anna never questioned orders from Moscow Center,
especially choosing a dark gray suit of moderate cut and cloth, a white shirt, and a solid navy blue necktie. Examining his appearance in the mirror, he concluded he had achieved the desired effect. He looked very much like an officer of the Royalty and Specialist Protection, or RASP. A branch of the Met's Protection Command, RASP was responsible for safeguarding the royal family, the Prime Minister, and visiting foreign dignitaries. Keller and the rest of the RASP had a long day ahead of them. He went downstairs to the kitchen and watched BBC Breakfast to its conclusion at 8:30. Then he pulled on a respectable Macintosh coat and climbed the steps to the street where Tony was waiting behind the wheel of the MI6 car. As they headed eastward across London, Keller's thoughts once again drifted to the woman. This time, he removed his MI6 BlackBerry and dialed.
"Where are you?"
he asked. "Just leaving the dining room." "Anyone interesting at breakfast?" "A couple of birdwatchers and a Russian agent."
"Just one?"
"His girlfriend left a few minutes ago."
"Do Gabriel and Grant, in a Saudi prison and subjected to various forms of torture, including electric shock, waterboarding, and threats of rape. It is imperative these women be released at once. Otherwise, we cannot proceed with our relationship as normal."
Abdullah managed to conceal his astonishment. He'd been assured by his foreign minister and his ambassador to London that the meeting would be amicable.
"Those women," he said calmly, "were arrested by my nephew."
"Be that as it may," Lancaster shot back, "you are responsible for their current confinement. They must be released at once." Abdullah's gaze was level and cool. "The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia does not interfere in the internal matters of Great Britain. We expect to be shown the same courtesy. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has directly and indirectly helped to turn this country into the world's preeminent center for Salafist jihadist ideology. This, too, must end." Abdullah hesitated, then said, "Perhaps we should move on to the next item on the agenda." "We just did."
"I need to have a look inside your bag."
Anna removed it from her shoulder and held it open. The officer examined it thoroughly before allowing her to pass. The terrace of houses along the western flank of the square were some of the grandest in London. 3 bay windows, 5 stories, a basement, and handsome portico supported by 2 columns, each bearing the house's address. Anna climbed the 4 steps of number 70 and placed her index finger atop the bell push. The door opened, and she went inside. Though Anna Yurasova did not know it, the team at Hatch End was monitoring her every move with the help of the CCTV cameras. Ailey Lavon, who was following her on foot, was a mere insurance policy. After watching her enter the house at 70 Eaton Square, he walked west to Cadogan Place and lowered himself into the passenger seat of a Ford Fiesta. Mikhail Abramov was behind the wheel.
"Looks like Gabriel was right about where the Russians plan to do it."
"You sound surprised," replied Lavon.
"Not at all. The question is, how are they going to get to him?"
Mikhail drummed his finger that would take place there in a few hours' time.
"It is essential you behave normally," she said. "Just ask him what he wants to drink, and I'll take care of the rest. Can you manage that, Konstantin?"
"I think so."
He took her by the arm.
"There's one other thing you should see."
"What is it?"
"A surprise." He guided Anna into a small, wood-paneled lift and pressed the call button for the uppermost floor. Dragunov's enormous bedroom, the Chamber of Horrors, overlooked Eaton Square. "Don't worry, I brought you here only for the view."
"Of what?"
He nudged her toward one of the 3 bay windows and pointed toward the southern side of the square.
"Do you know who lives right over there at number 56?
"Mick Jagger?"
"The chief of the Secret Intelligence Service. And you're going to kill his prized asset right under his nose."
"That's great, Konstantin. But if you don't take your hand off my ass, I'm going to kill you too."
The topic they reserved for the working lunch at Downing Street was Saudi Arabia's most thorny issues involving human rights. No, he was not satisfied with all of the Crown Prince's answers, including those regarding the brutal murder of the dissident Saudi journalist Omar Nawaf. "It was," said Lancaster in conclusion, "an honest and fruitful exchange between 2 old friends." With that, he shook Abdullah's hand and gestured toward the waiting Mercedes limousine. As the motorcade departed Downing Street, Christopher Keller ducked into the back of a black protection command van. Under normal circumstances, the drive to Abdullah's private residence at 71 Eaton Square might have taken 20 minutes or more. But on empty streets with the Metropolitan Police escort, they arrived in less than 5. The square's CCTV cameras recorded that Crown Prince Abdullah entered his home at 3:42 p.m., accompanied by a dozen robed aides and several Saudi security men in dark business suits. 6 RASP officers immediately took up positions outside the house along the pavement. 1 member of the detail, however, remained in the back of the protection command van, invisible to the woman standing in the 3rd-floor window of the house next door. As though he were being interrogated.
"The usual channels, Konstantin. What difference does it make?"
A moment passed. Then Dragunov said quietly, "There would have been no lectures if you had come to Moscow instead of London."
"If my first trip abroad as Crown Prince had been to Moscow,
It would have sent a dangerous signal to the Americans and to my rivals inside the House of Saud. It's better to wait until I'm king. That way, no one will be able to challenge me. Be that as it may, our mutual friend in the Kremlin would like a clear signal of your intentions.
And so it begins, thought Adola. The pressure to live up to his end of the deal. Cautiously, he asked, what sort of signal? One that makes it abundantly clear that you don't plan to go your own way once you become the leader of a family worth more than $1 trillion.
Dragunov's smile was forced.
With wealth like that, you might be tempted to forget those who helped you when no one else would go near you. Remember, Abdullah, my president invested a great deal of arms, knives, explosives. But never once had she rehearsed opening a bottle of Louis Roederer champagne under conditions of operational stress.
When the cork finally shot from the bottle with a loud pop, several costly ounces of frothy liquid spilled onto the counter. Ignoring the mess, Anna reached into the pocket of her maid's apron and removed a Pasteur pipette dropper and a slender glass vial. The clear liquid inside was one of the most dangerous substances on Earth. Moscow Center had assured Anna it was harmless as long as it was in its container. Once she removed the cap, however, the liquid would instantly emit an invisible fountain of lethal alpha radiation. Anna was to work quickly but with extreme care. She was not to ingest the substance, inhale its fumes, or touch it. On the counter was a serving tray with two crystal champagne flutes. Anna's hands trembled as she unscrewed the metal cap from the vial. With a Pasteur pipette, she drew a few milliliters of the liquid and squirted it into one of the glasses. There was no scent at all. Moscow Center had promised it was tasteless as well. Anna screwed the cap onto the vial and shoved it into the pocket of her apron, along with the pipette. Then she filled the two glasses with the champagne and, with her left hand, picked up the tray. The contaminated glass was on the right. She could almost feel the radiation rising with the escaping effervescence. She pushed open one of the swinging double doors and snared a few linen cocktail napkins from the bar. As she approached the drawing room, she heard the Saudi speak a name that made her heart give a sideways lurch. She placed a cocktail napkin before him, and atop the napkin, the contaminated glass. Dragunov, she served directly from her right hand to his. The oligarch raised the glass formally.
To the future, he said, and drank.
The Saudi hesitated.
You know, he said after a moment, I haven't touched a drop of alcohol since the night I returned to Saudi Arabia to become crown prince. She can get you something else if you prefer. Are you mad?
The Saudi swallowed the entire glass of champagne in a single draught.
Is there more? I don't think I can get through dinner at Downing Street without it.
Anna reclaimed the contaminated glass and returned to the kitchen. The Saudi had just consumed enough of the radioactive